degrees in Kenosha, wind chill is minus 8. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
Welcome you to the Monday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg.
Today's morning show, we're going to be exploring a couple of different concepts and several different terms that get bandied about quite a lot, but probably most of us do not really stop to thoroughly consider what they mean, and in particular, how they impact our lives as individuals, and our lives more collectively as communities and cities and states, and ultimately as a nation as well. We're going to be talking with one of the authors of a book called The Privatization of Everything. And this is a book which talks about the public good and how much of what we think of as the public good has been, in a sense, co-opted by the private sector. And The two authors of this book, Alan McCallion and my morning show guest Donald Cohen, see this as a largely negative thing and maybe even a destructive thing, a destructive force on our country and on our democracy. And so that is the purpose of this book, in which they explore, in a sense, how we got here and how we can get out of here if indeed this is a situation that we as a nation need to, in a sense, shed. And along the way, they help us think about terms like privatization and the public good and the private sector, and maybe help us sort of re-examine things that we perhaps take for granted. And who knows, you could potentially get to the end of this book, I suppose, and maybe feel like this privatization is still a largely positive thing that should be maintained. But I suspect that after reading this book, you will find that notion very much challenged. The book again is titled The Privatization of Everything, How the Plunder of Public Goods Transformed America and How We Can Fight Back. It's published by New Press. Donald Cohen is, as I said, the co-author, founder and executive director of In the Public Interest, which is a California-based think tank that has explored many of these issues. Donald Cohen, we welcome you to the morning show.
Well, it's a pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me.
I feel like I've really learned a lot from your book, and in particular, I think it's a terrific book for getting us to think about things that we tend not to think about very directly. And I guess in particular, this notion of privatization of public goods, public affairs, in a sense, shifting into private hands is something that we sometimes see in very overt and dramatic ways. And in other sectors, it's something that is, in a sense, much more subtle, and we might be completely unaware of it. Is that a fair summary of what of that and that complicated factor of all this?
Yeah, it absolutely is. It's subtle. And, you know, what's interesting about how you describe that is also government services in our lives are sometimes invisible to us, even though they're all around us. So there's sort of a level of invisibility that in the face of ubiquitousness that, you know, there's private in our lives and there's public in all of our lives. And so this is what, you know, what the book tries to do is disentangle that, you know, make us more aware of the public in our lives and show how private interests sometimes get control over those public things in a way that's not necessarily in our interest.
Right. Your book, interestingly enough, begins with COVID. And I think it's a really interesting choice. And the preface of the foreword, but specifically begins with March 13th, 2020, which is towards the very outset of the United States. Explain why you chose to start the book in this way and explain what this, in a sense, real life example of privatization of the public sphere is all about.
Sure. So, I mean, I COVID has dominated all of our lives. In many ways, it was an obvious choice, but it was also the perfect choice in some ways to talk about the core idea of the book, private control over the things that we all need, over public goods we all need. So I think it's become clear, at least to many of us, hopefully most of us, that the health of all of us depends on the health of each of us. That's what, you know, that COVID has really underlined that point, and emphatically so. When the pandemic first unveiled itself, the Trump administration at that time decided their first response was to say, you know, the private sector can deal with this, free market can deal with this. Let companies make and sell masks and testing equipment, and the market and its magic will kind of take care of all of that. And that was their approach. Now, it was obviously a disaster. What happened was states were competing against other states for, to buy on the market, in the market, protective equipment and testing equipment and all of that. Prices were going way up. There was price gouging going on and simply unable to meet what was clearly a public health crisis. And so the market, in terms of the idea that the market can't solve a problem that is all of us. It just can't be done. You need a level of public coordination and participation. And, ultimately, the Trump administration launched Operation Warp Speed that made government agencies, federal government, coordinate the response. And, so the market completely failed, even though it shouldn't have even been tried. And then public institutions had to come in and, and get us on a better path.
So it was a partnership of sorts, but you would probably term it kind of a flawed partnership. And at this outset, maybe not even much of a partnership at all.
Well, it wasn't a partnership at all at the beginning. And then it became so. But there's, we needed Pfizer and Moderna and Johnson & Johnson. It's always public and private, if we have to think about it. But we needed the government to say it's for everybody. The federal government grant, they didn't give a grant to Pfizer, but they committed to a large pre-order. So essentially they funded the project. So, it was the federal government coming in to pay for the development of the vaccines and the production of the vaccines. That was essential to make that happen. So that gets to a place of a good partnership. Now there's a little bit of a wrinkle in that they allowed and continue to allow Pfizer and Moderna and J&J to own their patents, outright without any ability to let generic manufacturers, make the vaccine, not just in the US, but globally as well, so that we can get more shots in arms. So there's still too much private control and a great deal of profit happening. There's still too much private control in the pandemic, but it's a little better than it was. We just need to take it to that next step. And the federal government has the power to do so, to make the patents available to all to start producing at a higher level.
And I want to clarify right off the bat that although the COVID-19 pandemic figures fairly prominently in your book, this is not a book solely about that. That is just the initial example that you use to help us understand what's going on for good or for ill in terms of the private sector's increasing involvement in what we think of as a public sector and the public good.
Well, and I mean, the other reason for that is that we wanted, you know, the book is organized by around large public goods and public things. And so the first chapter was always going to be about public health. The first chapter was always going to be about public health, and that's clean water, that's safe food, that's, you know, it's access to vaccines. It's a whole set of things. And so COVID is about public health, right? I mean, our response to COVID depended entirely on, or to a great extent at least, on the how robust our public health system was. And so it was both sort of the obvious entry into a larger issue about how we need to keep everyone healthy.
It seems to me that another reason it was a good place to start your book is that the COVID-19 pandemic is also something that has had pervasive impact on so many sectors of society, even aside from specifically public health. That's obviously at its heart what this is about, but I mean, it has affected, I mean, higher education where I work and education at every level and the performing arts and athletics and the economy as a whole and so on. I mean, it has impacted us on all kinds of different levels, and that in a sense magnifies the significance of what you were just describing in terms of how much of our fight against COVID-19 is actually taken up by the private sector versus the public sector.
That's a great point. That's exactly right. I mean, had not the federal government intervened, the economy would have been in much worse shape. People would have been evicted in huge numbers from their homes. Millions of people lost their jobs. It also sort of shows how it all fits together, how interdependent we are in so many ways. You know, we didn't want to get on the bus, so we couldn't go. You know, if you didn't have a car, you didn't want to get on the bus to stay, to be healthy. It means you couldn't move around, right? And we need people to be able to move around. If you can't go to university, you can't go to school, you don't get educated. I mean, it all fits together. And, you know, health is at the core of that, but everything is at the core of it. A knowledgeable country is at the core of it. A healthy economy is at the core of it. So it's absolutely true. And I could give you another example. I just learned about it around the issue of public health and universities, which might be of interest to you. So a number of universities are now privatizing their dorms. They're doing public-private partnerships to rebuild dorms, to build new dorms, and let, you know, private companies in long-term operating agreements, you know, run them. So there's a company that's doing this in a bunch of places. Universities, as you probably know, you know, shut down for a little while in terms of having people on, you know, kids on campus. And as some universities wanted to start bringing students back, but at lower occupancy in the dorm for social distancing, for public health, they received a couple of universities that I looked into, Georgia State and Wayne State in Michigan, received a legal letter from their private partner, the private operator, that says the following. The university does not have the unilateral right under the agreement to institute a policy that would reduce the occupancy in the dorm. Okay, so that's control. By virtue of a long-term contract, that private company has control over what the university should have control over, the health of their students.
Wow. That is interesting. For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with the co-author of the new book, The Privatization of Everything, How the Plunder of Public Goods Transformed America and How We Can Fight Back. My guest is Donald Cohen. He co-wrote this book with Alan McCallion. Mr. Cohen, we should probably take a moment to clarify the way you are using some of these essential and central terms in your book and in this conversation. And let's talk specifically about the term privatization, which adorns the title of the book. And why don't you explain to our listeners how we commonly think of this term of privatization and how you want us to think about that in maybe a broader sense?
Absolutely. So many people are aware of privatization when George W. Bush wanted to privatize Social Security. That kind of put privatization at the center of the, you know, of our national discussion at that time. So, you know, people often think it's about privatizing a prison, which it is, you know, letting a private company run a a prison, or sometimes outsourcing trash pickup in your town, or the bus drivers in your school system, or selling off a water system to a private, a municipal water system to a private company. And there's lots of different examples in pretty much every kind of service that we can, public service that we can think of. I mean, they may think about it in terms of war as well. There was an enormous amount of, number of private contractors used in our wars in both Iraq and Afghanistan. That's sort of a new feature of American military policy. How we think about it is a slightly broader term. All those things are accurate and true, but I define it as follows: as private power and control over public goods. In other words, and then I'll take it one step further. So what do we mean by public goods? It's the things in our definition that we all need to survive and to thrive. We need health, we need education, we need knowledge, we need to connect with each other, we need democracy. There's sort of a large things that we absolutely need to function as a society where everybody can, for the essentials. Now, all those things that I mentioned are true, but it's also true that you think about something like childcare, which is in the news now. Childcare, pre-K childcare is fundamentally a fully privatized public good. You're a family, you have kids, you need childcare. It's pretty universal at this point. But essentially, there's a mix of some public and some private, but it's fundamentally you're in the market as a parent looking to shop for affordable, high quality childcare. It's incredibly unaffordable the wages are too low and there's lots of turnover and everybody needs it, right? So that's in my view that, and that's not, it's something been outsourced. That's something that we just haven't raised the money, the public money to do what we know we all need.
When you are talking about what we mean by public goods, those things that we all need, I really appreciated how you went on to talk about a couple of terms that weren't familiar to me. I mean, not that I don't understand them. I mean, they're sort of self-explanatory, and yet I don't remember encountering them, especially in conversations like this. So you tell us, according to economics textbooks, and according to many economists, that public goods are things that are non-excludable and non-rivalrous. So that first one, I think, is pretty self-explanatory. So it is either impossible or impractical or maybe morally wrong to prevent people from using those things, because as you said, they're things that we all need and deserve to have as part of our lives. What about that second term, non-rivalrous?
Well, I'll use an example for both to give you a sense. It's a streetlight. A streetlight, you cannot exclude someone from using the streetlight. If you're on the street, you can use the streetlight, the overhead streetlight. And that's the non-exclusive. Rivalrous is if you're using the streetlight to read your map, someone else can walk up next to you and read their map. Your use does not impact their use. Okay, so that's kind of what that's public. That's what they mean when they say this narrow definition in the textbooks about public goods. Now, it's not just things that we need. So, healthcare is technically, in their view, a private good. Because you can exclude people, we do, and there are only so many doctors and nurses and hospital beds. We know that it's a limited resources. So we've decided, we've allowed the economists to decide what's a public good, or the economic terms in the market to determine what's a public good, and I disagree with that. We should be able to decide what's a public good. We should be able to say everyone in America should have the same level of healthcare and the same quality, regardless of their income, their status, their geography, any of those things. That's a democratic decision that we should have.
So in other words, it's not just that specific sectors that we think of as the public good have been co-opted by the private sector, but even the definitions themselves have also been co-opted by the private sector.
Yeah, it basically says the market gets to decide what we can do or not together. If the market allows us to make something universal, then we will. I mean, it's a little bit of an exaggeration but not, right? It's really what that means. And let me make one other point about the idea of public goods in our view. It's also the things that we can only do if we do them together, right? If we want every person in America to have healthcare, we can only do that if we do it with some level of government involvement. Even if there's private involvement too, the government has to play that role. If we want to clean the air, because clean air and should be is clearly something we all need, you can only do that with government involvement, whether it's regulation or whether it's purchasing or any number of things. You can't do these things. And then the last example is if you want to be able to send a letter to every corner of America for the same forever stamp of 58 cents right now, you can only do that if the government's involved. You can only do it that way.
What was the start of the pathway in this move towards massive privatization? When and how and why did this begin? What do you see as the outset?
Yeah, there a couple. I mean, governments have been contracting for things forever. So let me just say that. I'll come back to that. But what became important about that? Most people think it was President Reagan, that he was, you know, came in and said, "I'm from, you know, the 9 or 10 most terrible words in the American language, or I'm here from the government. I'm from the government, and I'm here to help." I mean, people think he launched the push towards privatization. It turns out that's not really true because he tried but failed. The Democrats were still in, controlling the House and the Senate. And so it just wasn't the right time for that. Okay. Bill Clinton got elected. H.W. was in the middle there, but Bill Clinton got elected and he really began to implement, you know, Reagan's ideas about privatization. He asked Vice President Gore to lead something called the National Performance Review to improve government. Functioning, which is a fine thing to do. And services was baked deeply in. The idea that we are customers of public services is deeply embedded as an idea, as opposed to citizens with obligations and responsibilities. And then I think the biggest thing that got privatized was welfare reform. When welfare reform happened, I think it was 96, TANF, it was the first time a major social service was, you know, in the statute allowed to, and big pieces of it were allowed to be privatized. And so Clinton was really the big push. And then it's been sort of in that direction, you know, all along. Now there's a couple, I'll make one final point about this. It's the idea of the private sector will do it better. The other idea is that the market should be the right instrument. Market competition is the right instrument to be able to, you know, improve services and expand their availability. I disagree with both of those things, but I think those are sort of the ideas that got, that Clinton kind of embedded in governance and that have, you know, survived for quite some time.
I think we should talk about that matter of the private sector is better at doing this than the government is. The private sector knows how to do things efficiently, especially cost efficiently, and so on. And I think that's a contention with which you, whatever you want to say on that, isn't it probably true that there's some kernel of truth there? I mean, that because otherwise, how would these ideas take root so decisively? I mean, aren't there in fact real life examples of governmental bureaucracy in fact not being particularly efficient, or are they better efficient at certain things than at other things? Or maybe it's a matter of, even if they're appropriate for the government to be in the driver's seat versus the private sector, that's one way to answer, but I think your answer is also
exactly. I think, you know, large institutions are complex. There are good, well-run businesses. There are poorly run businesses. There are well-run governments. There are poorly run governments. It's about management. It's not about the inherent nature of the institution, whether it's a public institution or the private institution. Now, there's no question. We, you know, we all have private in our lives. We buy stuff, you know, we going out today to buy the sector. The issue is, and I don't want to divert too much, but the issue is here is, you know, is the computer made in a way that's and to the environment? That's a public role, not to make the computer, right? So we don't kind of look at the dividing line there. There are, you know, you could go deeply into that. So let's, you know, there's good government, there's poorly run government, there's government that doesn't have the resources it needs to be to do its job. There's private sector that are, you know, taking too much money out of this, you know, spending too much money on the wrong things and are doing poorly. It's an abstraction that I think is not productive, honestly, even though we deal with it all the time.
Right.
But let me get to the efficiency argument, because I think it will help illuminate it a little bit more, because we deal with it all the time. Fit sector, cheaper, better, faster. Okay. So, and, you know, more efficient. So when you say more efficient, what do you mean? You mean you're going to spend less or expend less effort to get the same or more out at the end, right? You're going to come up with new ways to do things, and you're going to spend less on them. So when the private sector says, you know, going to privatize a prison, and they say cheaper, better, faster. So we say, okay, well, what are you going to spend less on, right? Because it's real things. Right, they could have fewer workers. They could pay them more poorly. They can have lower quality food. All these things have happened. You could have less air conditioning in a hot place. I mean, you know, just sort of occupancy costs. That's what they mean by less expensive. And so there's a privatized juvenile facility in Mississippi. I think they may have closed since. They went from a staffing ratio of corrections officers to inmates from 12 to 1 to 60 to 1. Okay. Bad things happen when you do that. And there's other examples of that. So that's what they mean by saving less. We have to interrogate the question of efficiency, right? What you're going to spend less on. Because the other thing you have to remember when a private company is operating something, they have other costs. They have returns to investors. They have executive compensation, which is typically, you know, much higher, and for at least for publicly, you know, large corporations. They have lobbying expenses. They also have debt service because they're, you know, they often will buy other businesses. So every one of those dollars, legitimate business expenses. But every one of those dollars is a dollar that's not going into the service, right? That's not either paying the corrections officers more, so you have lower turnover and less violence in the prison, having using those funds for better mental health services, because our prisons are, you know, our mental health system in this country, unfortunately. Those are choices of how we're spending the money. So I just think it's, when they say the word efficiency, I always like to really just break it down.
Right.
When they say the word efficiency, I always like to just break it down into real things.
Right. And certainly you're calling us to not be simplistic or careless when we talk about an equation like the private sector is more efficient. Is it really? Let's examine that really, really closely.
Sorry to interrupt, but it's not the private sector. Like I said, it's some private companies that run well. There's no such thing as the private sector. There are private companies, and there are good ones and bad ones and in between ones.
Right. Just like, government can handle its business efficiently or non-efficiently or someplace in the middle. Let me ask, I just realized I had no intention of this question is only occurring to me now. Is it possible for there to be a for-profit prison, for instance, just since that's what we were talking about, a for-profit prison anchored in the private sector that in fact is run humanely and in such a way that the quality of that institution is largely similar to if it were a publicly held and publicly run prison? Or is there something inherent about it being for profit and in the private sector that is simply not possible or so unlikely as to be kind of beside the point?
Yeah, that's a good question. So with the issue of prisons, which are a little different, I think that it's immoral I actually believe it's immoral to for a private company to make a profit on incarceration. But let's set that aside to ask the, you know, so I can answer your specific question in that way. So is it theoretically possible? Yes, they get paid by per diem, right? So if they were paid enough money to make sure that the wages, of, you know, that the compensation was high enough, there were well-trained corrections officers, you know, all of the stuff, and there were limits on how money can be extracted from returns on investors. If you really write a rigorous contract and fund it, fully fund it, then theoretically that's possible. But what's really important to understand is that their incentives are different. And it's okay. Private businesses do one thing. They sell things, right? And that's okay. But private prisons sell heads and beds. That's what they sell. The more, the better, right? The more they sell, the more money they make. It's just very simple and straightforward. But that's not necessarily in our interest. We want to get people out of prison, right? So, for example, so these incentives get baked into these contracts. So there are private prison contracts all over the country that have bed guarantees in them. Keep the beds filled at 80, 90, there were somewhere 100%, or pay anyway. Now, it's because they're, in, you know, they want to get paid their interest to be protected. They've signed a contract. But again, we're, you know, let's say occupancy does go down and we're still paying at 90%, that money could have been spent on job training programs or mental health or these other things. And then, you know, add another thing is, since they want to sell more, they will, you know, they are in fact involved in public policy to make sure that there's more heads and beds. So it's all about their purpose, which is to sell things, and the incentives that get baked into these deals.
When it comes to terminology, another distinction that we see in your book more than once, and I think it's a really significant one, is how we look at ourselves, that is, as people, in terms of whether or not we see ourselves and the decisions we make as consumers versus as citizens. First of all, from what side of this equation are we being pulled to be, think of ourselves as either citizens or consumers? And what kind of difference does that make in terms of the scenario that you are laying out for us?
That's another great question. So we are being pulled in the direction of being consumers in a couple of ways. There's a set of ideas out there that believe government should be very small, and then we should meet our needs in the market. I mean, that's, you know, and I'll read a quote about education from Milton Friedman, one of the, you know, most conservative economists in the 50s and beyond. He says, in my ideal world, government would not be responsible for providing education any more than it is for providing food and clothing, right? So there's a worldview that says all this stuff should just be in the market and we should just be able to choose what we want and, you know, and go buy it and go get it. So that's a worldview. The second piece is that the second push in our direction is the more we are asked to pay for things as public services, as the consumers, you know, tolls, water fees, you know, more and more, you know, shift this cost onto the individual, then we really are being pushed in that direction of being a consumer, right? Which, as you know, other issues about equity and affordability and all that. So there's sort of that other sort of push in that direction. Because governments don't have the resources, you got to get it somewhere. We need to pay for things. And so we'll put the price on the individual. What that does, what those two things do, is that they, you know, make our primary identity with, you know, with respect to government, as consumers of services, as opposed to citizens that see our destiny tied together, that see, understand that we're interdependent, that that shows that we are, you know, connected to each other, that we have obligations and responsibilities to each other. So I think it's an enormously significant thing, because if we don't see ourselves connected to each other and in fact are not connected to each other, that's an assault. That's a direct assault on our ability to function, be a functioning democracy. Hmm. We've got to understand each other. We've got to have shared experiences. We have to trust each other. But if all we are people who are buying stuff for ourselves and thinking about ourselves, you know, why do we need each other?
Right. And I think what you are describing plays out in every one of the sectors that you explore in your book. But in some ways, the clearest example of it is in part six of your book, which you title Things in Common, Privatization and the Erosion of Community, in which you explore the way in which this occurs in, for instance, public places like parks, and when it comes to our schools, and when it comes to our libraries, and so on. And it seems to me that this is also maybe one of those examples that is all around us, and yet maybe to some extent largely invisible to us. What's at the heart of your concern when it comes to this particular sector?
Well, thank you for drawing attention to that chat, that section. It's my favorite in the book, because I think it is at its heart, in some ways, the most important. In you know what I was saying before, if we don't, and things in common, if we don't share things together, don't interact with each other, different types of people in different places, like we do in parks, like we do in libraries, then we don't see ourselves as committed, in common purpose to solve our larger problems. So I think it's, you can't solve racism if you are not connecting with people of different races. For example, you can't solve immigration reform unless you have a better understanding of the lives of the people who are, coming across the border, putting their lives at peril to come across the border. You have to be able to understand a perspective that, different perspectives. I think, in America, nearly 2022, we have an enormous empathy deficit in this country. It's a very serious thing in our lack of understanding. The last section of that chapter in that section is about Social Security. And that's because the reason we put that there is because that's a community of the whole. We're all, as you get older, as soon as you hit 62 or 65 or 70, you're in Social Security and you have some level of economic security. It could be better and all that. It's not, you'll need more perhaps, but we're all in it together equally, right? And so that means we've decided that we want people seniors to be able to be economically secure with Medicare. We want them to have health care. We've decided that as a people. And if there's an effort to dismantle it, we're all in it together and we'll stand there and we'll defend it, right? So we'll defend our public good, because we're all in. If it was just a means-tested program, those other people didn't really, where it's only for the poor, then why would you fight to keep it? And, that's probably their fault anyway, because they didn't figure out how to save money, out of an individualist worldview. So I think the importance of us being connecting with each other, I can't underline more.
I want to ask you about the distinction of the public sector and the private sector, in the sense that I think when we talk about this, and particularly when you talk about how you believe this drive towards privatization also drives economic inequality, which I wish we had more time to talk about. But it occurs to me that when we're talking about the private sector, we're still talking about people. I mean, it's not like they're Klingons or Romulans that are preying upon the rest of us. I mean, the private sector is also us, in a sense. How does that kind of complicate the equations in terms of us thinking about this?
Well, I think it's maybe a little bit, I said before, it's about the purpose. It's about the institutional purpose, right? We're not against private companies, and they do things. They sell things that we want. They sell things sometimes that we need. I mean, that's what they do, and that's totally legit, and it's okay. But that's their purpose. Our purpose is health. It's democracy. It's economic security. It's mobility. It's our ability to move around. It's our ability to communicate with one another. So that's the difference. It's the purpose. Now, private sector does lots of things that, that plays a role in many of those things, but it's the public institution sectors that make sure it's done in a way that advances our larger public purpose. For example, I think I may have said earlier, food. We don't make the, government doesn't make the food in the grocery store, but they do make sure it's healthy,
they set, you know, the government, you know, but with laws and regulations and you know, government and inspectors, make sure that it's produced in a healthy and safe way, so that we maintain health. And that's the essential public-private partnership in all of it. We set the standards. We deliver it sometimes ourselves, you know, our institutions, but then we make sure even those private institutions and private individuals meet those standards. That's the right balance.
One of the most interesting examples you've given, I think, in the book about this encroachment of the private into the public concerns, I think, roads in Colorado, and how that was, in a sense, outsourced to, I think you said, a company in Portugal. And then when it came time for decisions to be made about improving roads, the state of Colorado, its hands were tied. That's because right. Some of those decisions were out of their hands. And so it's probably important to underscore that fact that much of this is about control, about who gets to make really important decisions that impact the general public. And if it's a company in Portugal with their own bottom line, that's probably cause for concern for anybody who drives on the roads of Colorado.
That's right. And that control is institutionalized in contracts, which are very rigid documents. That particular contract was 99 years long. The Northwest Parkway is the name of the road. And so in these long-term infrastructure, public-private partnerships, they're referred to as roads, bridges, water systems, things like that. There are what, you know, in the contracts are things that referred to as non-compete clauses or compensation clauses. And essentially what they say is that, you know, there's a road there that you know, a contract's been assigned, you know, for the private company to run the road, to collect the tolls, and, you know, et cetera, that the government agencies are prohibited or limited in some way, and maybe perhaps prohibited, depending on the language in the contract, from creating an alternative transportation method, a nearby road, upgrading a nearby road that is free, if that road or mass transit, you know, or light rail would compete with the private road, privatized road. They're called non-compete clauses. And they are common, you know, that's a terrible one. Nobody signs 99-year deals anymore. But those are common features in private contracts, in infrastructure contracts. And, you know, you think about it from the business perspective. You know, you signed a contract. We made plans based on what we thought our revenue was going to be. You change the deal. You know, you got to pay us, that would be the compensation clause part, or we just make sure you can't do it. But the problem, you know, again, it goes to public purpose and private purpose. Our public purpose is to get people moving around in an affordable way. And you've literally tied our hands. And this happens all over the country.
I guess this is a case where if such partnerships are necessary in certain instances, we better be darn sure that those agreements are very carefully made, not carelessly made. In our last few minutes, I want to give you a chance, at least briefly, I'm afraid, to talk about what can be done for those who share your concern. I mean, your book is not just an exercise in hand-wringing, but also a book that lays out some strategies for perhaps moving the needle back in a way that you think would be positive for us as a nation and for our communities. You talk about how this so-called pro-public movement needs to be moving and is moving on two parallel tracks. Explain what those two parallel tracks are.
You may have to remind me, actually, that I think about it in that way. So first track is the idea track and the value track. So see if I got this right and how you're thinking about it. It's been a while since I've read that chapter. So one chapter is we've got to, you know, consider ourselves again citizens. You know, we've got to say all, you know, that when we say the public, we mean everybody. We've got to eliminate all exclusions. We've got to realize that we have obligations to each other. We've also got to realize, you know, in an environment that is a political environment that's fairly anti-government, you know, over many years that's happened, and there's, you know, that's not an accident either, that we have to realize that there's public all around us, And that some of it's pretty good, right? I mean, we just, you know, I said earlier, it's both invisible and ubiquitous. You know, you turn on the tap, and water comes out. It's kind of a miracle, I think. We don't think about it as, oh, that's the government serving me, but it is. The paint on our walls used to have lead in it. So I think that's, you know, super important that we, what I call surface the state, realize it, and then remember the public purpose of those things. The other level.
No, I was just going to remind you, but it sounds like you've remembered, is confronting privatization itself then.
That's right. And confronting all privatization at that level and being aware of what's around you is asking really hard questions, thinking forward, the 99-year deal, you know, making sure before a deal like that happened that you really think, what could happen? What decisions might we not be able to make? What could happen to our regional economy? Are we going to be driving in 99 years? And are we going to have an albatross on our... So really interrogating the decisions with public purpose and recognized as a rigid document. So you better make sure, is it a private prison? Are you going to make, you know, what's going to happen with the wages and benefits? Has a huge impact on the, both the workers and the safety of the prison. So it's all of those things at both levels.
You say a little later in that section, our approach, meaning you and your co-author, is both idealistic and practical. And so it seems to me the idealism is kind of understanding the whole notion of the common good and then being practical in terms of the nuts and bolts of what happens to all of us and to our lives and to what we depend on when that balance of public to private is tampered with for the sake of someone's profits. Well, we've just scratched the surface in terms of what is offered in your fascinating book, which again is titled The Privatization of Everything, How the Plunder of Public Goods Transformed America and How We Can Fight Back. And the book is published by the New Press, and the co-authors are Donald Cohen and Alan McCallion. Donald Cohen, I've really enjoyed this conversation. I found your book profoundly thought-provoking, and I'm really glad we could have this conversation about it. Thank you so much.
Likewise. Thanks for having me.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, you'll hear an interview that I recorded several years ago with Wisconsin's own Michael Perry, a very, very popular author with public radio listeners. And this particular interview concerns a book of his called Montaigne in Barn Boots, An Amateur Ambles Through Philosophy. On Wednesday, you'll hear my conversation recently recorded with poet and writer Ravi Shankar, whose new book is called Correctional, a Memoir. In it, he talks about the experience of growing up in America as the son of immigrants from India. He talks about struggling to sort out his sense of identity, his career in public education, a career which was interrupted for a time when he was thrown in prison, and his perspective on life in the criminal justice system, all told in this book called Correctional, a Memoir. On Thursday, an interview from several years ago with John Grogan, best known for his blockbuster bestseller Marley and Me, but we'll be talking about his very personal memoir called The Longest Trip Home. And on Friday, an intriguing book about business leadership, Joe Luizzo and Elazar Aslan, and their book Boundless Leadership. It's exactly 9 o'clock. The Morning Show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock. You'll find the program archived on our website, WGTD.org. And 7 days a week, you can also hear The Morning Show at your leisure in its podcast format. Be sure that you look for The Morning Show with Greg Berg. Today's going to be a sunny day and cold with a high temperature of just 21 degrees. It will be clear and cold overnight. Our low will be 15. Tomorrow, some relief in the terms of temperatures.